Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers in the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. For the final time this year, and indeed this decade, I am here with prominent foodie Thea Leonarduzzi. Thea, hello.
Hello, that sounds very serious, isn't it? For the last time this decade.
Oh, I thought you were criticising the prominent foodie.
Oh, no, problem. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, exactly.
You're setting me up for failure, but yeah.
No. this week I sent you a picture of my pasta pesto.
You did. Thanks for that.
Well, your response was, does it have pineapple in it?
Yeah, it looked a bit sweaty also.
How can it be sweaty? It's just pasta. Look, we've talked about this before. My Christmas dinner at home is everyone in my house picks their favourite food for Christmas dinner. So my daughter's going to have a toasty.
A toasty?
Yeah, that's what she wants at the minute. I think my son might have pizza. I'm going to have pasta. And then we'll see where we get to with everyone else. I was interested. You're not going to do this tradition. I'm aware of that. But if you did, what would your Christmas dinner of favourite food be?
Any food.
That can't be your answer, by the way. You have to specify.
Any food would do.
I just like food.
Famously not picky.
Yeah, exactly.
I will say my grandmother's gnocchi, because you can't buy those. And
what sauce would you have?
Well, her sauce. So her gnocchi made with her sauce, and her sauce is a ragu of it's pork and beef mince, and it's very, very fine, and she cooks it for absolutely ages on the oldest stove I've ever seen in my life.
So actually your and my Christmas dinners I'd like that for my Christmas dinner. Can she? No,
it can't happen. Although that said, she did once, there was an Easter when I couldn't make it over, and so she gave my sister to bring back to me a little, in a cart door case, you know, old ice cream box, some gnocchi that she'd made, and she just put a bit of oil on them to keep them separated, and a separate jar of her ragu, which miraculously made it through Italian security at the airport, because they said, oh, what's this liquid? And my sister just said, oh, it's my nonna's ragu. And they were like, in that case, on you go.
My mum sends me every Christmas sausage meat and celery stuffing, which I used to have at Christmas dinner when I had to have Christmas dinner, and I really liked it. So when she comes to visit just before Christmas, she brings a frozen, box. They're in balls sausage meat and celery stuffing.
Will you have them with your Christmas dinner?
No, I'll just eat them.
Or just a snack?
Well, yeah, I like them in a sandwich. I like them in a cob.
Oh, cob. You would say cob, wouldn't
exactly,
you?
Exactly. What would you say?
Probably a bap.
A bap. None of it's good. Lovely. Well, that's food done. If you're not a subscriber to the TLS, here's how to become one. Use this special offer code and get on board, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. You can get 5 issues for £5 or dollars. Get it for yourself and your friends this Christmas. I should also remind you that you can buy TLS merch at our new shop. Just go to our website and follow the link. And that includes 2 books we have published this year, Genius and Ink by Virginia Woolf and The Hero by Lee Child. I saw this week that The Hero was the best-selling ebook in the whole country. Hooray! I know, so much commercialism, but that is what Christmas is after all about. This week we're going to be reviewing the whole decade with a crew of TLS editors. Did we ever agree on our collective noun for TLS editors, I wonder? A shush? A wag? Anyway, in the paper we have a special 12-page retrospective touching on issues from academia to gender, the novel, film and more. So we'll talk all about that. First problem of this decade, and there have been, let's face it, many of them, is what to call it. The 10s, the 2010s, both feel already sub-iconic, as if this was a period that struggled to be definitive, to be something worth packaging up and theorising over. David Horsepool, who we shall meet shortly, said this in his own roundup of a decade of history writing. We are still post 9/11, mid climate catastrophe, in medias res digitalia and pre-AI. I know it exists, but it feels like very early days. Politics had its big lurch around the middle of the decade, consequent on the great financial faceplant of 2008, and is still reeling now, having not wobbled into any sort of stable equilibrium. That is true, but it's not going to stop us having a go at drawing some lessons if we can. We'll use the various submissions of TLS contributors as our guide, including Mary Beard on academia, BJ Silcox on fiction, John Stokes on theatre, Zoe Williams on gender, and much more. To do that, here in the studio is a veritable shush of TLS editors, Ros Dineen, Minister of Fun, the aforementioned Horsepool and iconic Northerner Lucy Dallas, and we've got champagne.
Woo. Yay!
Where yeah. is it? Okay.
That was a bit there, belated, wasn't it? Yeah. Can I object to a shush?
Okay.
A what, murder.
Give me another.
No, not a murder. Something.
A sigh.
Something stylish.
A sigh. A grumble.
What did you? What was the other one? No, I don't want to be a panache.
A panache.
A panache. That's
yeah,
good.
That's I what think, I'd like.
Does that mean
can
shandy?
You say that,
does that mean shandy?
Well, panache.
Yeah, I mean, sort of, but it also means like you know.
Mm. What was I going to say? A wag.
Wag sounds better.
A wag?
I thought we settled on a sigh of editors.
No, but,
that's
time,
but that's
yeah,
very depressing.
Yeah.
Quite accurate.
It sounds awful.
Yeah, it's funny because it's true. Yeah. We all have a sigh. Right, I'm going to open some champagne while we're talking because we've done this great review of the decade. So let's talk about what we think of it. Is the only lesson or the main lesson to draw from this, that this is the decade or has been the decade of identity politics? Do we accept that from reading this or otherwise?
Is identity politics a neutral term?
Oh, big question.
Very good question.
I think it is. Because I think to me it's which makes clear that identity issues, issues of who you are rather than what you do, is more important. And that can be a good thing because you might say that identity has been overlooked because there's been a whole rush towards just assuming that a certain group of people should always be in power. So being conscious of identity politics isn't necessarily a bad thing, or you could conclude that it slightly occludes looking at the actual deeds rather than the people doing them, so it's a bad thing. But I think the term in itself is
well,
neutral.
I would say that two of our contributors who've taken on those subjects in this roundup are Mary Beard
yeah,
and Zoe Williams, and I wonder if you said to them, this has been the decade of identity politics, if they would not say, well, yes, but. And the reason they would possibly disagree with you is because identity politics is usually meant negatively.
Is it a bit like
people.
Political correctness?
Yeah,
that's what I think so. Yes. That originally, that's yes, not how it was meant, but it has actually become a at least slightly loaded and slightly derogatory term for something which you can argue very strongly is an unalloyed good. Maybe not unalloyed,
has,
a good.
Yeah, has it
a
turned good out to be an unalloyed good?
Well, and nothing's an unalloyed good, is it? Apart from puppies, maybe.
No, they're
even
maybe,
then.
Yeah,
they're
exactly
lovely.
Yeah. No, they're coming. Should we just talk about dogs?
Yeah.
I'm going to try and open some champagne, which may be an unalloyed good as well. Go on, Ros.
One of the points that Zoe makes in her piece is that lots of the identity politics issues and things like LGBTQ rights have all been weaponized.
Listeners, Jake has made a terrible understanding of all of the expensive electrical equipment.
It did not go on the electric.
Producers disappeared.
Yeah, there's producers in a horror. I don't think we're allowed to bring drink in here, are we?
No.
Oh, we have now.
No, it's a good job you didn't open any champagne in the studio.
That was good though.
Isn't
that
what happens?
Sound effect.
Every single.
Also the timing of that.
Yeah. What were you saying, Ros? I felt that I sort of punctuated. Weaponized.
This is a bit of a cliche though, because in every radio show and podcast at this time of year, everyone goes, "Oh, we're not meant to bring champagne in here."
Do they? Oh, you're all right. You're the podcast expert, Ros. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to podcasting in a minute. In fact, hang on, David, is that a handkerchief?
Yes.
David Horsepool.
Of course,
as a gentleman and a scholar, you have a handkerchief.
I do.
And uses it to mop up champagne.
Right.
That's what it's for, I think.
I don't think I did that in any particularly bad way. It was obviously just a chop.
I think Elle shook it.
It's very nice.
Like Lewis Hamilton.
Elle, my assistant, who's leaving me, her parting gift was to shake up some champagne.
Zoe argues that a lot of the issues have been taken up by people who don't really care about them and used and weaponized and used against the people who do believe in them to split us all up from each other.
And there's some argument, the argument perhaps most obvious where that's the case, where people who perhaps aren't concerned about feminism are concerned about burqas. So people who would not live their lives constantly worried about women's rights all of a sudden grow a conscience about women's rights when it comes to Muslim women in burqas, and therefore the Zoe Williams argument would be that's weaponized by weaponizing one group against another. But is it true of the arts, I suppose? Well, let me talk about academia. Mary talks about academia where she says, effectively, we all think it's a place of snowflakes and people wondering about identity. And she kind of implies it is a bit, but not as much as we think.
Well, yeah. She also says that...
who else wants champagne, by the way?
Plenty of...
Has everyone got some? Lucy?
Plenty of issues happening... That there were politicians, that there were students talking about things in her day.
Yeah.
And they had their own issues. It's just that it wasn't called identity politics. That was a particular movement in favour of X or Y or Z. Maybe it was civil rights or maybe it was women's rights or, you know. But it wasn't called identity politics. It was just students asking.
Well, without wishing to be indelicate about it, we've all been to university at slightly different times.
Oh, unbelievable.
Do we remember that? I don't really remember much identity politics.
Just full stop.
Well, no, I just don't remember it being very political. It may have just been me, though. I don't know whether it was not a political time. I was at university just as Blair was 2 years, a year in. So maybe there wasn't much politics about then. Was that the end of his
election?
Was that the end of history type period, wasn't it?
It was a little bit, wasn't it? I mean, I think when I, many years before that, was at university, the very big thing, two big things that happened politically were Nelson Mandela being freed and the end of Margaret Thatcher's premiership.
And
so it seemed a fairly... Yeah, it was just... Yeah, the poll tax. So that was another kind of victory for the march of kind of liberals. So I suppose it seemed to sort of bien pensant university goers as if we were in the ascendancy, things were going right for us.
We got rid of
Thatcher, we got Mandela out, you know, these... That's what students were meant to do. They were supposed to end apartheid, did that. Got rid of Mrs. Thatcher.
Well done, yeah.
All just by not turning up to lectures.
But were you all in together in that respect? That wasn't groups...
Well, there weren't many people who kind of... I mean, I did... You always meet weirdos. But, I mean, there weren't many people who objected to Nelson Mandela coming out of prison.
So it wasn't a question of... I mean, the snowflakery charge is a slightly different one, isn't it? It's not necessarily just that the politics are more based on not beliefs like... ending apartheid or opposing Thatcherism, which are effectively ideological beliefs. It's more a suggestion that it's based on groups being pitted against each other. Does that seem to be a new one? Or an intolerance of even discussing things? Maybe that's
the snowflake, that's the charge.
Yeah.
Isn't it? The snowflake charge is that people can't stand things being talked about. But what Mary says is that there's a lot of talk, it's partly what Zoe Williams says as well, that people, in order to weaponize it, people pull out very extreme examples of things. So maybe this has happened twice or, you know, I don't know, a handful of times across the country. And what happens is that these same examples get pulled out again and again. Oh, somebody was cancelled and asked not to speak. And in fact, in the vast, vast majority of cases, people do speak. People do have discussions.
And it's the same people who don't get asked, as it were, you know, and they're usually on some kind of tour, and they are able to publicise that rejection far more easily these days.
I thought Mary made a really good point, which is that it's now seen, if you're teaching classics, you have to give trigger warnings because you're going to be talking about rape, and then that's seen as basically students not being able to willing to face reality because they're too fragile to handle it. And Mary's point, which I think is a really interesting one, is we're only confronting the genuine issue of rape existing in classic texts for the first time now. When she was learning it, it was sort of euphemised and talked about just as the ravishings and just things that existed. And so who knows how people would have reacted 30 or 40 years ago if it was being taught in the same way that it is now.
I think that's absolutely true.
I mean, when I learnt about the event called The Rape of the Sabine Women, it was kind of explained that it didn't really mean what you think, what rape, it meant taking the women away. And then it wasn't kind of spelt out, well, what do you think happened to the women once they've been taken away kind of idea. Mm. Whereas now, yes, I mean, they're facing exactly the same reality that, in fact, those classical authors were writing about fairly plainly.
And as she says about the rape of Lucretia as well, which is, it is absolutely seen in terms of what it did to the Roman Empire. That's how you talk about it.
Yeah.
That's how it was always taught.
But maybe this is where the conflation with identity politics comes in, which is that it's clearly, there's no problem when you're confronting difficult issues of things like rape. It's not snowflakery. It's not, when you're dealing with them, you should deal with them sensitively and appropriately and take into consideration the individual context of people. That feels like a fairly straightforward argument. The difficulty is perhaps where it's not about that. It's about people who have different political opinions, different worldviews, where that's not about troubling details. That's about not wishing to hear an opposing argument, not wishing to ever think that you might be wrong about something, which is a broader societal problem that has grown up outside of universities as well.
And that must be the experience of Western universities, that there are just more people from different backgrounds, social, political, religious, and so on, who are there and whose voices are going to be heard, and they may make it difficult for people who've always talk the same way to hear them. But, you know, Mary, who's writing in, you know, about the end of a long and distinguished
45 years, she says,
classical, I mean, she doesn't call it long and distinguished, I think I could call it. I mean, she's obviously able to, you know, you are able to move with the times if you want to, and not just be trying to catch up and to bring people along with you. So I think, you know, there are obviously ways for people who are in academia to respond to it without just caricaturing it.
Yeah, although I think Mary probably would concede the point, there is still intolerance in all ends of this, though. I think the snowflakery charge isn't completely dismissed, even by Mary's piece.
No, but the snowflakery charge is unlike an actual snowflake, the only one that sticks. Because since when were incels famous for listening to other people? Since when was Steve Bannon good at allowing other people's points of view? If you look at the other extreme, they're not famous for listening and for dialogue.
No.
But the snowflake thing is the thing that stuck, that everyone is, you know, oh, you're too liberal and wishy-washy and right on. But it never seems to get applied to the other end.
But we may have had an election in this country where the piety of the left has been seen to be unpopular. You know, this was a Labour vote that declined by 9%, and where there is a contention, I'm not saying I believe that, there is a contention at least that the people who were running the Labour campaign were saying things that were not of interest to the people who should be voting Labour, and because they were interested in areas which are of less importance to people elsewhere in the country. That's the contention made against Labour.
What do you mean by talking about...
This is the identity politics argument. The identity politics has become more of a pressing issue for some people than others. It's a sort of the split in the country.
I think that's hard, really, to sustain. I mean, we'll have a piece... No, we have a piece saying, actually, not in this feature, but in this issue, saying that it's more down to personal appeal or lack of it at the end of the day. And I'm sure that has a lot to do with it too.
Do we feel there's a certain amount of people just grouching and saying, you know, this is the world we live in, it's full of these things that I don't wish to accept? Maybe that's what the charge will always go up like that.
Well, quite probably. And in the meantime, as Mary points out, it's a big distraction, a distraction from other things that are happening inside the universities. Discontent and underfunding by the erosion of a proper career structure for many young academics, by needless attacks on the established pension scheme, and by conflicts over what students should pay for their education, when and how. And we're in a period now where there are mass strikes across universities in the UK for precisely those reasons, the pension scheme in particular. And it just sort of sends us into the next decade in a really precarious way, where we really have to ask, what do we value in our education system?
Yeah, and how much you're willing to pay for it.
Exactly.
Lucy.
Yes, hello.
John Stokes, mm-hmm. who writes about theatre for us.
Yep.
This is still in the area, if we're using identity politics neutrally, or at least in the area of identity maybe, that's a more neutral way of putting it, take the politics out of it. Mm. He writes about, this is a decade in which blind casting became entrenched, and he himself kind of experienced a greater understanding of the complexity of it. What does he say, and should we agree with him, do you think?
Well, should. I don't know about should. I would also slightly quibble with entrenched. Every question you put to me, I'm going to ask it.
Fine.
Is that really?
That's how that's how politicians prosper, generally. Answering the question. I'd like to answer that question by asking you a question.
Yeah, I would. Entrenched also makes it sound like a bad thing. to me. I think it's more that
established was established. Yeah, was merely the maybe synonym I was grasping for.
What he's saying is, I think that that in theatre, of course, there has been a long tradition of certainly cross casting, gender casting, going one way basically. That you had men playing everybody because of the social conditions of the time, and now the gender casting has been changed quite a lot, and also they call it blind or sometimes colourblind casting, in that it seems to me to be a really basic point, in that if you are acting, you don't have to look like the person that you are acting. Indeed, sometimes people will be acting, they will be being a horse or an apple, yeah. And nobody ever says, well, that's clearly a male apple. Do you see what I mean? I mean, my whole thing about it, I just think it's all made up.
Doesn't quite accept that point entirely, does he?
He doesn't, and I'm stating it very, very simplistically. Yeah. He says there are levels of it. And one example that he says that he thinks is particularly brilliant, he says, which is colourblind and colour alert, and you can be both of those things at the same time, he says, is the all African-American production of the Arthur Miller play,
Death of a Salesman, yeah,
which is on in the West End now. So they haven't changed anything. They haven't. And he says, and it's still all American, still applies to America, perhaps puts a slightly different light on some of it, but it's still about family. It's about the same things. The people that you're looking at are slightly different.
Which is why the argument that blind casting actually doesn't mean blind casting.
But it never means blind.
No, exactly. But it's a funny phrase, because you can can blind cast an orchestra. You could literally sit with your back turned to the orchestra.
That happens now.
Do you know they
it?
Do that now? Yeah. Because before they did that, they didn't employ any women.
Yeah. So if you're blind, you can genuinely blind cast an orchestra. You don't look at them and you listen and you like that and that, and there you've got an orchestra and you've had no. You can blind read a CV.
Does it make a big difference when they blind cast orchestras?
It did. Yeah. They I think most of them do it now because it made a huge difference.
Right.
Yeah.
But you cannot blind cast a play.
No. And it's like actors. You know, it matters what you look like at some level.
Well, the point is that Stokes makes it...
It's almost impossible not to. And what you sound like. Absolutely.
There's a phrase he used which I think is very good. Physical appearance can provide evidence of identity, and there's no point in pretending that it can't.
But he does discuss a play which plays with that, a production which plays with that, The Doctor at the Almeida recently, where part of what is going on is that people are blind cast, as it were. You know, there are black actors and white actors, but some of them are playing cross-racial roles. And at some point, someone will say, you're saying that to me because I am black, and they're not, or the other way around. At some level, it can seem a bit kind of trite or kind of gamesy, but actually it's rather brilliant because it forces you to readdress all those things, because you haven't already made up your mind, oh, well, this is going to be part of the story.
And that's this notion of it being a conscious artistic decision. And there seems to be two things here. There's one at the level of art, which is it is interesting to have people of different backgrounds playing roles because it makes us look at the play differently. Yeah. So the Arthur Miller one, really good example. It makes us look at Death of a Salesman differently because it's about a community that's underrepresented and marginalised just as the community that Arthur Miller was writing about was, or in a different way.
Yeah.
So at the level of art, that kind of works. And then there's the level of opportunity, which is it must be right to try and make sure there's a proper opportunity. But this kind of gets caught in this notion of blind casting, which seems to me to be implied that it's sort of arbitrary, it's unthinking, and it seems to me it's the very opposite of unthinking, either at the level of art or at the level of opportunity or both.
Yes, and I think that's just a function of the name. I mean, you could call it something else.
Yeah, and I suppose it's worth bringing up the objection that you do, that has been heard, that there aren't many white Othellos. You might say, okay, blacking up is no longer done. There's the kind of Laurence Olivier thing. Okay, so that's, you know, unless you're the Prime Minister of Canada, you don't do that.
That was unbelievable this year,
wasn't it? A memorable moment.
Yeah. He couldn't name the number of times he blacked
couldn't
up.
Couldn't name the number of parties he hadn't.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It was so off-brand, that, for him.
Or was it?
But, exactly.
To return to Othello, there aren't, as far as I know, perhaps I'm wrong, there aren't, and there really should be, in a way, white actors playing Othello. But, you know, one argument about that is, goodness me, there aren't that many parts for black actors. Why take one away, which is the only one that Shakespeare wrote for a black actor?
I think if you've had 500 years there's basically been only one part.
Exactly. However, having said that, if we're truly
blind about it. There's absolutely no reason.
I think, you know, if it were all perfectly level and everything had always been exactly equal, then sure. The opera is another area which is a bit slower. I mean, in a funny sort of way, it's always done blind casting and that the people didn't look like what they represented and people used to sort of, you know, make jokes about it. Opera's had quite a bad history in terms of Othello, blacking up for Othello, or Madame Butterfly, or the other way around, that some brilliant black sopranos would only ever get to play Aida, basically, and they kind of wouldn't get anything else. And that's opened up.
How optimistic do we feel? Because Alan Jenkins, our poetry editor, he's talking about poetry tells us the decade of women. So this moving maybe back to gender again, but do we feel that...
In a favourable way, we should say.
Yeah,
way,
exactly. Yeah, this was,
we should probably make that clear. He's not lamenting.
No.
Because he does start with a rather doleful list of all the people, as it were, that we've lost in this decade. But he says what we've gained is... a decade of women poets.
And do we feel that in, I mean, not just in poetry, which we may or may not be qualified to discuss individually here, but do we feel that, I mean, this is an era of optimism? Things are getting better in this area.
There's much better visibility, I think.
I was going to say, you say equality, but it's visibility rather than equality.
Yeah, and I think economically and politically and socially, I'm not sure.
But critically, it is, isn't it? Because even the most kind of... the areas of the critical world that you might think are the most kind of old-fashioned, it's kind of an accepted... You know, nobody writes about how, two of the actors were from one ethnicity and one was for another, and it was very... Nobody writes like that anymore because it would seem absurd.
Argument has been one.
So
that
argument has to me.
My only caveat would and it's brilliant, of course, that people hitherto not had a chance are being listened to and read and all of those things. That it's brilliant and it's long overdue. The only danger, I think, is that it's like, okay, we've done women, or you know, we've done African Americans, or we've done Asians. You know, it's just like, you know,
that's a bit of the theme of Zoe Williams' piece.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
We thought these were arguments that had long been.
Yeah, you don't want to be part of the it doesn't want to be a trend. But then you go back to business as usual.
Well, the three of us, Roz, Lucy, and I went to see Little Women.
Oh yeah,
last we did.
Week. Written and directed by Greta Gerwig. Also by Louisa May Alcott. You want some more champagne?
David's gesturing heavily for more champagne.
And that was written, directed by a woman, predominantly female cast, predominantly female crew. And that feels like an example of a film that would have been made in the past. I mean, it's been adapted 7 other times onto movies. But it feels that it's being adapted that way by this rock star of a writer-director. That feels like a film of its time, more than it otherwise would. Do you not think?
Perhaps, but also I felt when watching that film that they kept sort of having to make points and having to make statements about what women can do and what they can't do and all this stuff. And, you know, at one point, using the lines and saying, you might be obsessed with this man for 2 years, but we will be interesting forever. Like, don't give yourself away to him, all this stuff. And it's like, do we still need to say this? It's amazing to me that you still need in this blockbuster film to have a famous actress talking directly to camera and reiterating these points over and over again. It's meant to feel radical.
But that's in the book, though. And the book is not a radical book.
No.
Oh, I don't know. The things she says are pretty radical for the time.
Well, the outcome is not radical.
No, the outcome is
the second book is called Good Wives and everyone gets married.
They're just very good wives. Yeah.
It's not just a clever title, Lucy.
This is what Zoe says in her book, I might quote a little bit, but she says, you know, that we still struggle to address misogyny head on because it sounds so blankly improbable that a prejudice so painstakingly overcome by discussion, legislation, individual acts of courage, collective acts of solidarity, deliberated activism, and more amorphous tectonic shifts of culture should reappear, an ancient foe hideously reanimated by the methods, networks, and barbarisms of modernity. How the fuck did that happen? In our picture, we've got this illustration of, I can't believe we still have to protest this shit. And that's one of Zoe's points. It's like, and that's what I felt when I watched Little Women. Why is this radical still to have someone?
But I don't think to me that wasn't radical. It's an updating of the book. If you didn't have that, if you just had the book that quietly ends with everyone getting married and doesn't engage that, I think that would be worse in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. But I was saying about, I thought when watching that film, that they could have done that without over-egging those points.
Well, that's And interestingly enough, the Golden Globe nominations for Best Director were announced and all of the nominees were men.
Yeah.
And Greta Gerwig was not nominated for this. Now, whether you think she should be or not, it's a different point, but it's striking that even though there have been some very prominent female-helmed films this year, and even though Greta Gerwig is a kind of rock star, she's not been nominated.
Mm. The thing that struck me as well in Zoe Williams's piece is that there's a fairly basic statistic, which I think is difficult to argue, that things have moved on very much about domestic violence and women getting killed by their partners. Hasn't really changed.
Yeah. And the same with rape conviction, incredibly low and hasn't shifted in the past decade.
Yeah.
It's got down even.
It's gone down. And there's more, and this is in the face of more and more academic research that shows the link between domestic violence and extremism, you know, of any sort, really. Joan Smith has done loads of work on that, and yet we're still in the same place. Nothing has changed in 10 years.
Every time there is a terrorist attack of any politics, there are two things you can always conclude with your eyes closed. It will be by a man, and that man will have some
would
sort
have
of domestic violence conviction. So that is almost a great universal in these things. Maybe when we celebrate the visible, the danger is that we say, oh, great, Greta Gerwig's making movies, and, you know, I think there's now a majority of the new TV shows in America in 2019... there were more female leads than there were male leads, and the men in TV shows developed in America were more likely to be sidekicks and sort of boffins rather than the central players.
That may be affected by the removal of male leads from certain famous and replacement by female
for legal reasons. But that sort of visible change may mask a lack of change in other areas.
Exactly. Comes back to what Mary Beard was saying, what we were talking about at the very beginning, how things look different on the inside to they do on the outside, and the focus can be a problem.
Yeah. Let's talk about technology. Roz, you've talked about the decade of podcasts. You're always banging on about podcasts.
I'm always banging on about podcasts.
What is your thesis about podcasts?
I don't have a thesis so much. I started with the noise-cancelling headphone technology.
How many hours have you listened to noise cancelling? What does it say?
According to my Spotify account, this year I listened to 40,757 minutes of music. Mm. Which Adrian worked out how many minutes that was a day.
How many
hours? Can't remember.
Okay. A lot.
Hours.
Is it a lot?
It's roughly two.
It's a lot.
No, that's just music. That's just Spotify.
Really? And is that a good is that a good thing or a bad thing? What are you saying? Do you think we accompany? I always say to my wife, she can't. I'm the same in different respects, but she can't sit in a room without putting a podcast on now. So it's this notion that there has to be something always accompanying us. Is that how you treat them? Do you think they've become intrusive? Not intrusive, but they're part of our existence.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I sort of define two different sorts. So there's the sort that allows you to sort of embrace a kind of niche interest and block out opinions and views that you don't really want to hear or don't want to encounter, or the people presenting it will do that for you. So there are 700,000 podcasts, and many of those are very, like, you know, if you're pro-Brexit, there's something for you. If that, you know, you just find what you want is like an echo chamber.
Yeah, if you like freedom, books, flowers and moons.
For example, there's a place for you.
Yeah,
if you don't like those things,
then you wouldn't come here.
They're not listening. They're not listening.
They're not here.
That's true.
They're not listening.
Ross could insult them now and they'd never know.
Yeah, they wouldn't. But then I argue that the best podcasts that have happened, you know, have come about over the last decade, and the one I use as an example is S-Town, are the ones that look at that gap between what we hear and what's actually happening, what we choose to hear and what's actually happening. And they take that gap and they sort of mine it and mine it and mine it in ways that more traditional forms of journalism can't really do, because more traditional forms of journalism are always limited by space or time, and often have to be, even the best sort, have to be sort of come to some sort of binary conclusion or have to draw conclusions.
Yeah.
And the wonderful things about these podcasts, they can go on for as long as they want them to, for hours and hours and hours, can take you on this journey, is that you can actually get to quite complicated places where no one's right and no one's wrong and you're not quite sure what's happened. Yeah. It's all very human and real.
But they've created, like in publishing, once there's a good one, there are then 1,000 crap ones.
And then there's 1,000 crap ones.
And so the lesson of S-Town is probably been find a real life crime and solve it.
Yeah, or try to solve it.
Try to solve it.
Even
though in S-Town they don't solve it, and like you say, it's all about the human experience.
Mm.
In some ways, the lessons have been we better expose something, because that's done well a couple of times, and then the market's filled with imitations.
Yeah, and more so actually with Serial, which also came from the same people who who made S-Town. Serial really was unpicking an unsolved crime, whereas S-Town began with someone phoning up a reporter and saying, or emailing a reporter and saying, there's been a murder in this awful shit place I live and no one's looking into it, it's all been covered up. And the reporter goes and finds there wasn't a murder, but then finds that the man who contacted him is fascinating and peculiar, and there's a big mystery behind him.
Yeah, it sounds like a sort of character from a Donna Tartt novel. He's a southern clockmaker, isn't he? Was he a clockmender?
I mean, yeah. And has all this incredible expertise, has made a maze in his back garden. Yeah.
It sounds very meta. It sounds like a literary creation.
I mean, if I tell
it?
You, it goes from like a tattoo parlor to this thing about nipple rings to the woods. Like, it just goes everywhere. It's amazing. I've talked about S-Town an awful lot, though. But yeah, there have been lots of very derivative unsolved crime podcasts that have copied the format that are actually nearly always revolve around a dead female body, and she was really hot and all of these people might have killed her or be in relationships with her. And it's really salacious.
And that's true of genre thriller fiction, actually. One of the issues it's got is that it's often a dead female body, and even if it's a female detective now, which is probably more likely, it's still more likely to be a female victim than anything else. Should we talk about telly? Andrew Irwin, who writes a regular TV column with you, Roz, which we don't call Andrew Loves Telly, but
we'd like to.
We'd like to call it that, yeah.
Maybe we should,
yeah.
Roz likes audio.
Andy likes telly. Anyway, he says the big thing that's happened is that a TV is no longer that piece of furniture sitting in a room determinately and determinedly clever broadcasting. It's become a kind of abstract entity that exists equally on whichever screen is closest to hand. Do we think we've all changed how we watch telly? Before you answer, Andrew says that the top show of 2009 was Britain's Got Talent, and the top show of 2019 was I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
Did anyone here watch any of that?
No.
You see, we're like...
It's a real generational thing, isn't it?
Is it?
You know, my mother came around to babysit over the weekend, and she and my 10-year-old son watched the Strictly final.
Live. Yeah.
I suppose there are millions of people doing that still, so I think we could kind of be a bit snooty about what people's tastes are. And in fact, we had a column this year in which Ian Sansom, who stood in for Andrew a couple of times, grandly told us off for liking Fleabag, metropolitan comedy, and said that what everyone really was watching was Race Across the World.
And the Peaky Blinders, I think.
Yeah. And possibly Peaky Blinders.
And he brilliantly said that Fleabag was, I think he said Miranda with swearing, which is a brilliant thing to say.
It is possible to watch both.
I thought Fleabag was overrated a little bit.
Well, so did he. Yeah. And I think he thought that there was a lot of attention on Fleabag not on...
Sorry.
Because I think probably I came to it with too much hype, so I thought it was going to have to be Shakespearean in its conception, and it wasn't. And I just thought it was a little bit... It was beautifully written and beautifully acted, so I'm not saying it's bad. It didn't move me at all, and I thought it was too consciously pleased with its own brilliance, and that put me off. It felt slight when I think it was trying to be hefty. I mean, who am I to judge? But it didn't move me in the way that I thought lots of people said it was going to. So when I came to it, I was going, like, oh, fine.
It got lots of hype. But I think it's perfectly possible to like both. You can both like the brilliance of Fleabag and also Race Across the World.
With those two examples, you know, if you've paid a TV licence or possibly even not, you can see them. There is a problem with so much TV being on subscription channels of this variety or that variety that a lot of people haven't seen the big thing that everyone's talking about because they haven't got the right subscription.
Well, this is definitely connectedly the decade that any kind of synchronised viewing ended.
I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here is that synchronised viewing.
And Strictly Final. Yeah.
Well,
I think the big
things apart from those things, there is so much out there that everyone could very easily be watching completely different things at completely different times.
Pride and Prejudice was on telly.
Well, exactly, that's what I mean. And everyone knew...
Sunday night and everyone watched
they would be sitting down to watch that, and then the next day you would talk about it. Altogether.
And that's a big problem. We're sitting there talking about this post-election. This is the big problem for the BBC, because the BBC now is facing a Tory party with a huge majority that doesn't like the BBC for a variety of reasons. And the means of funding the BBC, to your point, David, a licence fee on television sets, feels absurdly anachronistic, not least because there's loads of stuff you can watch with no licence fee whatsoever, with no television whatsoever. If you invented the BBC today, you wouldn't invent the licence fee. And what looked like an argument that was kind of gets elevated occasionally but was always going to go quiet, now would feel, if I were running the BBC, and I saw a Tory party with an 80 majority in the House of Commons, the fact that one in nine magistrates' cases in Britain are about criminalising people who haven't paid the licence fee.
This is such a waste of time, isn't
it? And money, and yeah. This falls disproportionately on women. It feels that what we're talking about here is kind of interesting in sociological terms, but that's going to have a huge impact on whether the BBC in the end of... If we're having this conversation at the end of 2029... Is this the decade that the BBC stops being a universal service?
The other thing you probably wouldn't do if you were inventing the BBC now is say it should be a broadcaster and a huge news website, huge news and lots of other things website. Why should it be both those things? I mean, that seems to stray into two very different
worlds. And that's often where it gets into the worst trouble, when it tries to do clickbait stuff, or when I see things like, check out this long read on the BBC website. You're like, well, why are you doing long reads? Like, you're funded broadcaster.
Because
you're not
they
a fund. Well, yes. They can, exactly. Yeah. But that question is going to wobble, I think, over
and
the next decade.
And often the quality of the stuff is not in doubt. It's just whether it's a competitive advantage that maybe it shouldn't have in those kind of terms.
Also, a lot of it is available on Netflix now.
I'm thinking of their BritBox thing with the ITV. Yeah. Is Fawlty Towers going to be taken off Netflix?
Well, they're all going to have that.
We must know.
Because Disney have done the same. Disney are doing the same thing. So you could live in a world where you have to spend 40 quid a month on four different streaming services.
And you still won't see Song of the South.
What's Song of the South?
The racist Disney film that Oh, What a Beautiful Morning comes from. Or Zippity-Doo-Dah.
No, it's not Oh, What a Beautiful
Zippity-Doo-Dah.
That's Oklahoma, mate.
That is Oklahoma. Yeah, Zippity-Doo-Dah. I do apologise. Oh, yeah.
David's knowledge of racist Disney films is not what it might be.
No, I'm totally sorry.
David, finally for this section, history. Stop drinking champagne. Hang on a second.
I mean,
pour your champagne.
I've got a terrible cough.
Yeah, pour your champagne. I'll pass the champagne over there. Lucy, do you want some? There we go. Okay, while you're answering this question, everyone else can have some champagne.
Sorry.
History's in the past, David.
Yes, it is.
So it should be immutable.
Well, I'd just like to say history is not in the past. The past is in the past.
Oh, my God.
History means the inquiry, doesn't it?
Which is current.
Into the past.
Yeah. So what trends have you observed in your historical hot seat? As a fine practitioner of history yourself...
Kind. Too kind.
What books have you published this
Well, let's not talk about the books I've published. Let's talk about the books that other people have published.
But if we were to talk about yours, which one would we say?
We could talk about any number. I'm going to determinedly and determinately avoid that. One thing I say is that, unfortunately, what we mainly have with us is the dictates of publishing, which means anniversaries are a big deal in history, historiography, still in any terms of kind of popular history writing or stuff that crosses over between academics and popular history writing. So the big series of anniversaries that we've had are all around the First World War. So there's been a heck of a lot of First World War publication, although, of course, because publishing being what it is, everyone wants to get in first. Quite a lot of big First World War books were published in the previous decade, ostensibly because of an anniversary, but which hadn't happened yet.
And do we reach tipping point? I mean, you read a lot of these books when they come in, presumably, or you flick them. Do you ever learn more? I mean...
Yeah. I think it's perfectly possible to learn more about it. And there's been a long wave of revisionist, particularly kind of military history, about the First World War, which basically comes down to the idea that there's more to it than the sort of futility first day of the Somme kind of thing.
And also more to it than just, you know, nice white boys from Britain going to fight.
That's also true. So it's been the world aspect of it, the kind of globalising aspect. One thing that doesn't seem to me still to come through that much, even when we're talking about the war in its global context, is if you read about this stuff in English, you'll read about Brits and Americans and maybe imperial fighters from, say, India. But you don't actually read that much about Germans and even less about Turkish fighters, for example, Turkish soldiers.
So our globalisation really points in one direction only?
It seems to me a bit. I think you don't have to look too hard to get past that. One of the biggest books published on the First World War in this decade is a translation of a German book on it by Jörn Lehnhardt called Pandora's Box. I mean, which does take a German perspective on it, but it still, to some extent, kind of goes along national lines. But I think it is kind of becoming important that we've got that distance from something. It's the point at which something really becomes history. There's no one left there to remember it. And you can talk about, so historians can write about the way actually the, for example, the Allied military effort was a learning curve. They actually did get better at fighting, and despite all the losses and the horror and the blood, they got better at fighting, and that is how they won the war. It wasn't just kind
attrition.
Of because 4 years were up, yeah. sort of thing, or Hindenburg thought it was a stab in the back. It was because they got better.
Yeah. And that revisionism of the generals being all monsters has started to happen now more, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, again, that kind of British perspective, you know, it's always got to be remembered that the Western Front was more a French experience even than it was a British experience.
Yeah. We're going to finish things off by picking our Roz, I hope you've done this, cultural high points of the decade.
I did it because someone came over to my desk and was like, please read to the end of the script.
Read to the end of the email.
Because I know what you're like.
Fine. Get thinking or get remembering, Roz, if you have indeed thought of it before, and we'll come back to our own cultural high points of the decade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Competition time. Our friends at Barbican London have offered 20 of our TLS podcast listeners the chance to win a Barbican membership plus for a whole year. The Barbican is, as I'm sure you know, a major arts organisation with 2 galleries, 2 theatres and a huge concert hall and 3 cinemas. The membership plus package will get you free gallery entry, priority booking, discounts plus entry into the Barbican lounge as they look forward to 2020, a year in which they have the UK premiere of Damon Albarn's new composition, The Nearer the Fountain, the more pure the stream flows. And there's also lots of other stuff. Jazz pianist Chick Corea performing with Christian McBride on bass and drummer Brian Blade, and the screenings of Isabel Huppert in the Glass Menagerie, and Ivo van Hove directed Death in Venice. He's also got West Side Story this year, I think, hasn't he, Lucy?
He has, in New York.
In New York.
Yeah, and we're going to cover it.
We are going to cover it. To enter this competition for the Barbican, you need to email barbican.membership@barbican.org.uk. That's barbican.membership@barbican.org.uk. Quote the words TLS competition in the subject line. The competition ends with this decade on the 31st of December. Right, everybody, including Roz, let's try and name some cultural favourites of the decade. Points will be deducted for anyone who mentions the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games in 2012.
Oh. We were all going to say that.
Often people, as they look back on this decade, they say,
really?
Oh, remember the high point when Britain came together and the opening of the Olympic Games, and everything has been this sort of descent since then, as if that was a kind of high point of cultural cohesion.
It wasn't even the high point of the Olympics.
No.
It was good fun, though, the Olympics.
Yeah,
the Olympics,
Super Saturday was the high point of the Olympics.
Did you watch the opening ceremony?
Yeah.
I was on a rooftop next to the stadium. Next to the, yeah.
Wow.
What could you see?
Everything. It was amazing because we could see it on the screen and we could see it happening just then. Yeah. You could hear the crowds. And then when Dizzy Rascal came on.
With Bonkers.
Oh. And you suddenly realised that it was quite industrial around there. Every single rooftop was covered in people watching it. And everyone started screaming on screen, in real life. It was incredible.
Hang on a second. Are we making the argument here?
No, it wasn't. I was just telling my anecdote.
Yeah. I didn't watch it.
Oh, it was brilliant. I was in Scarborough.
Oh, my God. What were you doing
Tim
there?
Tim Berners-Lee came out of a box. Do you remember that?
So many things.
It's worth it just for that.
So many things.
You really are an iconic northerner, aren't you? In Scarborough.
I couldn't possibly say. No. I just happened to be in Scarborough.
I don't like moments of communal feeling, so I find that difficult. So I just think...
I think we can all vouch for that.
Yeah. In our own way, we can all vouch for that. Right, who wants to go first? Let's say ask Roz. Should we ask Roz? Because I feel that will prevent Roz from writing... covertly to come up with her own answer.
Copying other people's homework.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to say Hamilton.
Oh, Lucy wanted to do that.
Well, I mean, Roz. I feel like
no,
I've said
on,
it.
Go on.
What else can I say?
Why Hamilton?
Why? It was amazing.
Who's seen Hamilton then?
I've seen it, but before I'd seen it, I'd listened to the soundtrack.
I've listened to the soundtrack millions of times. So I feel like I know, and I've also read Ron Chernow's book, Hamilton,
which
if you read it, it is an act of absolute wonder that that book, which is a very, very serious, long, impeccably researched historical biography, how that produces Hamilton is one of the great alchemizing feats of creation, I think.
Yeah, he's just not necessarily someone you would think of. I mean, because I wrote about Ron Chernow's more recent book about Grant, saying what a great biography it was recently. He's kind of more obviously a subject for a kind of heroic biography, whereas the guy who introduced a credit system, or I can't remember, but he did something kind of serious and financial.
And they sing about it. I mean, that's the great thing is they sing about the issue of federalisation and tax structures.
Every single thing. And is it? It's Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah.
There's a now kind of iconic photo of him. He was on his honeymoon, picked up that book from the airport. And there's a picture his new wife took of him lying in the pool reading the book. And he read it, and I've heard him speak about it, and he read it and said that he saw the same story that you hear from of hip-hop artists in the book. He saw this the same sort of struggle and...
Amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
What's your favourite song?
Oh, Wait For It.
Oh, I like...
Controversy.
Yeah. I like... One Shot, My Shot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Sarah Churchwell, the academic, I was at a dinner with her, and she's seen it 7 times or something like that.
Really? Wow.
And I said to her, the problem with Hamilton, it seemed to me, listening to the soundtrack, is it ends on a kind of diminuendo. It's sort of, it's got monster songs in the first half, and the last couple of songs on the soundtrack, at least, are a bit like... And she said that's the sort of thematic point of it. It's about sort of...
But also the state, when you see it, so I like you, I knew it really well before I went to see it. And the first half is all about the songs. And the second half is so much more about the staging and the movement and the...
So you're not disappointed when you get to the end of it?
No. And everyone's bloody weeping as well.
For God's sake.
You wouldn't like that. No.
I think it really was a game changer, though, because it was such a weird idea. The first time anybody heard of it, everyone just went, well, that sounds mad. A rap, a hip-hop musical about the founding fathers. And then... It was just so inventive in every possible way and so kind of full of delight, and also brought a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily be there. They cast a lot of black and Asian and...
And in the London show, I'm pretty sure most of the actors are young Londoners.
I think they are. Most of them...
And it's a celebration of immigration. Immigrants, they get the job done. That's the sort of the conceit of the whole thing, isn't it?
It's just that kind of mixture of those two things. And you would think, well, that can't possibly work.
And it works incredibly well.
And they did it so well that it opened up. So I haven't seen it either, I've just heard it.
Mm.
All of my kids' friends, they all know it. They all know it off by heart. They can tell you things about the founding fathers.
Yeah, but they've not seen it.
No, because most people can't afford to see it.
There is an accessible way.
She's hogging all the seats.
She's terrible.
Yeah, there is an accessible way to go and see it, which is there's a Hamilton app, and every single day there's a lottery.
Yeah,
and
they're
that's
very
how we
good
got
about
our tickets.
That.
Yeah. And there are £10 tickets.
And in America they do $10 because Hamilton is the $10 bill.
Ah.
And it's just such a kind of generous and inventive and... sort of, you know, explosive in a good way. I think it had big ramifications.
Do you want my other ones quickly?
Go on then.
I'll be really quick. Transparent, which was an Amazon TV show, which is incredible and inventive and strange and shouldn't work, but does. The final season is a musical. The whole thing is a musical, and it's bizarre, and I can't recommend it enough.
But it works as a musical. Absolutely. Do you know which series was the first to do that, potentially?
Buffy the Vampire Slayer
did a song. Great series that was. Wonderful.
I was going to say Ferrante, but I'm pretty sure someone else is going to...
If only there was an Italian
if
figure.
If only there was someone else.
Also, pronounce it properly, Roz.
I did Ferrante.
She did
but not with an not with a sort of insouciance.
I thought with Brio.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, Roz. Thea, who would you like to nominate as your cultural highlight?
Well, I am going to go with Elena Ferrante, but I'm only going to do it... I'm going to do it because I can spin it multiple ways.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting because we started the decade with her L'Amica Geniale, which was 2011. That was the first novel of the Neapolitan Quartet, and that was translated into English in 2012, so pretty early in the decade. And then we now end the decade with another new novel by her. It's not in the quartet, but it is a novel by her. And it's interesting because, translated fiction. This is the decade when it's grown more than any other decade since records began. We're now at 5.5% of sales in this country are translated fiction, and most of that is literary fiction, whatever that means.
They still don't get paid well enough for it, do they?
And what that means is we've got these translation sensations, which I hate myself saying, but that's what it is. So we've got Carlo Vignauskard, who we'd never heard of before. We've got Ferrante, we've got Leila Slimani, Edouard Louis, Olga Tokarczuk, all of these people who no one had necessarily ever heard of in the English language. Now we have them.
Svetlana,
exactly, yeah. Alexievich. So it's also means it's been a decade for translators, for noticing translators, noticing the work of translators, how important translators are. So hopefully, he's hoping anyway, the next decade will be the decade when they get paid fairly.
Show them the money.
Show them the money for the incredible work that
they
do.
So are you saying, Thea, that contrary to what some people might say, it's been a decade of cosmopolitanism?
Perhaps.
In some way.
The decade of Brexit and yet the decade of that.
Yeah, which is interesting. And maybe the two aren't entirely unconnected. Lucy Dallas, Roz has stolen yours.
Roz has stolen Hamilton.
She tried to steal mine too.
She did.
See what she does
here.
Even
though I went first.
Yeah. I tried to steal Lucy's Hamilton when we were talking about this lunchtime.
But Roz has it's already done. A thing that I think that this is quite a London thing, so I apologise for that, but the new theatre, The Bridge. I think is a new and wonderful thing. Puts on a lot of really good shows, one of which, The Midsummer Night's Dream, which you also saw, is one of the best things I've seen for a long time.
Loved it.
In terms of completely giving yourself up to something, and it was very inventive.
And the staging is brilliant. And although it didn't, if you watch it as a member of a groundling, it does end with a disco. Well, I can talk about it now because it's over, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It's finished now. Yeah.
So it does end with the stage disappearing and these giant disco balls falling down, and
it's the
cast.
Moon. Yeah.
Dance so
with everyone.
So the whole there's like 200 people watching it. There's some people seated, and if you're standing, and then ends with effectively a disco. So Titania,
sort of celebration,
and Bottom, and everyone stay on stage. I obviously backed awkwardly to the corner and
like,
just.
It sounds a lot like Punch Drunk, kind of theatre, which was
immersive stuff.
Immersive theatre, which happened a lot.
It's a bit like that. They were very clever about it because it wasn't quite immersive.
I wouldn't go to immersive theatre.
No, you were the audience.
So, and that's what I think the virtue of it. It keeps you. It means you're not being sort of mortified by it.
Yeah.
And I could back into the corner
with Julius Caesar.
Julius Caesar's
yes,
great.
They did. Yeah.
Another great production.
Very, very. I mean, there were so many aspects of it that were brilliant, and that was one of the brilliant things—the sort of management of the crowd without.
Yeah,
without
I think I probably reviewed 12 productions of Shakespeare for you, Lucy, this year, and I would say the top three would have both from The Bridge. Two of them would be from The Bridge.
Yep.
And the third, I think, would be Twelfth Night, the Malvolia.
Tamsin Greg one,
yep. Playing Malvolia, which is just this brilliant. Right. Did you see that?
Yes.
And it was lovely, wasn't it? And she was magnificent, and it was funny, and it was the staging was brilliant, big stage.
It was really confident and just completely recast the play as well. Yeah, I loved it.
So I think that's a big thing. There was a magic flute directed by Simon McBurney of Complicité. Who I love anyway.
Oh, well done.
And that was
raise the tone.
That was
well
just
done.
That was very, very good. And I was just thinking of one actually now. When I went, this is a thing I went to see for work, Spell Songs, which is about Robert McFarlane's and Jackie Morris's Lost Words. Just really, really, really beautiful music. So I would recommend it. It bears re-listening. Wonderful. And it's a good cause, i.e. saving the whole entire world.
Yeah, I'm not sure we're doing that brilliantly, but David Horsepool.
I've got some. Got one.
How many?
25. So let's get on with it. First up.
Would anyone like some more champagne while David is doing? Have some more champagne. In. Yeah, go on.
Well, I saw it. I know.
Is it Richard III, the book by David Horsepool?
It is not.
Is it Cromwell?
I did see a good David. Richard III with Martin Freeman, you've just reminded me, at Trafalgar Studios. In fact, I saw several
A Very
Richard
British
III.
Rebel, is that one of your books it's called?
English Rebel.
English Rebel.
Yeah, sorry.
But my play of the decade, which I know was written in 2009, but I saw it in 2011, is Jerusalem.
Jez Butterworth, well done.
I saw the last night of its run in London, and it was completely mesmerising. In fact, I said to my wife this morning, I've got to think of a cultural high point of the past decade. What do you reckon? And she said, without missing a beat, well, Jerusalem. And I said, oh, yeah, that was what I was thinking of. So it really kind of stuck with both of us.
Not technically this decade, though, David.
Well, it is, because 2011, I believe, is in this decade.
Go on.
Can I jump in to say that Ferryman, also, Jez
saw that too.
That was
jolly
incredible.
Good.
And I saw that in the first week. Well, it was a previews.
Definitely in this decade, that one.
And that was definitely in this, probably about, 4 years ago, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible.
Not as good, though, I didn't think.
I thought it was brilliant. And when I saw it in previews, there was a scene where they were sitting at the table, two of them talking, and, you know, the things are getting more kind of unsettled and there's something sinister, and the lamp caught fire.
Oh, my goodness.
And they dealt with it, in real life, and they dealt with it brilliantly, and it just became this symbol. They've just worked it into the text.
That did not happen on the performance. No, I saw so that was definitely
that's live theatre, isn't it?
That is live theatre.
And there was a live goose on stage.
Oh, yes,
was that on purpose? And a real baby. They were both supposed to.
Exit pursued by a goose.
Can I have another highlight, which is Untitled Goose Game. Sorry,
I don't know what is Untitled Goose Game.
It's a video game. It's brilliant. It is brilliant.
Sorry, David. Continue.
Number 23.
Well, there was the duck in the attic as well, but no, I won't. Ibsen's Wild Duck at the Almeida was quite.
Come on, you've got two more. Maybe.
All right. Well, here's one from left field.
Go on.
My artist of the decade, Kamasi Washington, the fantastic West Coast saxophonist who I've seen now, I think, four times, sometimes jamming with other people. And I saw him at festivals, but then I got a chance to see him at Late Night Prom, where he, if you don't know, Kamasi Washington is a saxophonist who plays with a huge band, which he then augmented with an orchestra for a triple album called The Epic. And he played much of it at a prom at the Royal Albert Hall with BBC Orchestra. And it was just mind-blowing. And I was looking back on my emails with my friend who I went to see it with, who's a proper jazzer, because I am not. We were just kind of exchanging how blown our minds were. And I couldn't talk in any technical way about it, but he just, one of the most memorable things I've seen.
Go on, last one.
Rather smaller scale. Detectorists, the brilliant TV series.
Oh, I've not seen that.
It's kind of the complete brilliant. Opposite.
Yes.
It's like a wonderful miniature detectorist.
You can't imagine Kamasi
quiet.
Washington
yes,
backing
very quiet.
The detectorists. But obviously, having historical interests, and there's lots of stuff about digging out Anglo-Saxon treasures, so that kind of completely fascinated me anyway. But the characters are just wonderful. Mackenzie Crook and Toby Jones are brilliant. And I remember Adam Mars Jones tripping over himself to praise it.
Yeah,
he did. Yeah,
he
doesn't often do that.
He gave it a lot of popcorns.
Yeah, five popcorns. Next year, by the way, for all Adam Mars Jones's reviews, we're going to make him rate out of five popcorns, aren't we?
He's just learning about this now.
Yeah,
he's
on this podcast.
He's not listening.
No, he's not. I hope he's not listening, because it will be a shock to him. I'm going to end then, probably tying together what we've talked about at the beginning, because I think the cultural moment of the decade in film was the success of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which actually did bring issues of identity and inclusivity and free expression into the mainstream. Action films in the 80s and 90s were much more based on individuals, much more based on violence, and there's a certain sort of right-wing aesthetic to them. And the biggest films now, and this is true slightly of Star Wars as well, but the biggest films that are selling out cinemas are Marvel films, and they are based deliberately, consciously, on the idea of people being the same beneath their skin. That seems to be the central aesthetic of them, and that I find fascinating that that mentality is now so mainstream that the biggest films are embodying it. That must have an impact on things, mustn't it? If that's the politics, in the true sense of the word, of it, that must have an impact.
Let's meet back here in 10 years' time.
We'll be back here in 10 years' time. The smell of champagne will
please
have drifted.
Let's not.
Please let's not, Thea. All right, for God's sake, just pretend. Please let's not.
Please help me, says Thea.
David will probably produce two or three more historical books.
I'll be here, even if Thea is running the
world.
I'll
be drinking the champagne.
You'll be drinking the champagne. We'll be talking about a couple more new books by David Horsepool, like Richard III, A Ruler and His Reputation, which came out in 2015.
Splendid.
Great book. That's all we have time for this week, this month, this year and this decade. Our thanks go to David Horsepool, Roz Deneen and Lucy Dallas. We have loved bringing you this podcast over the last 12 months. Thank you so much for supporting and listening. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS. We'll be back next year for more of the same. From Thea and from me, have a wonderful Christmas and a peaceful new year.